This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. On the local news roundup, Charlotte's murder count rises to 46 with four murders just this week. The number of Democrats running for Charlotte mayor increases by two. It now stands at five. Republican conservative Ralph Norman retains GOP control of South Carolina's 5th Congressional District House seat in a tighter-than-expected race. And the family of the young woman who died after being infected by a brain-eating amoeba sues the U.S. National Whitewater Center. Our roundtable of reporters is set to talk about those stories and more. Tom Bullock is here from the WFAE newsroom. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
Glenn Birkins is editor and publisher of QCityMetro.com and still has time to be here this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business. Good morning to you.
Good morning.
And Sean Flynn is managing editor at Spectrum News Charlotte. Thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
You can reach us through email at charlottetalks@wfae.org. Search for WFAE on Facebook, where you can also see us this morning on Facebook Live. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. Everybody's waving at the camera. And you can use the hashtag WFAE Roundup. Well, a murder over the weekend and three on Tuesday night brings the murder count, as I said, to 46 on the year. That's more than double the number at this time last year. I think it was 22. Mm-hmm. And of the 46, CMPD Chief Kerr Putney says at least 34 of the victims knew their killers.
These are not random acts. These are volatile outbursts where people grab guns and settle minor disputes. About half of them, though, here's what's quite troubling. About half of the homicides we've seen so far this year, the people, the victims, the lives taken away were between the ages of 18 and 34.
So could all of those things that he just talked about and that I just mentioned, could they all have been said about the murders at this time last year?
I think you probably could have said those things. I just think that the numbers are higher this year. There is no when you look at motive, there is no real pattern mm-hmm. there. Some numbers that he gave at that press conference, 11 of them were domestic-related, 8 were robbery, 7 resulted from argument, 7 were drug-related. I think the one common denominator that we're seeing this year that we probably would have seen last year or any other year is that, sadly, a disproportionate number of those victims and perpetrators are young African-American males. That seems to be the factor that whether the homicide rate is high or whether it's low, that continues to plague the city and cities around the nation.
And in Charlotte's case, the north and east parts of the city are disproportionately affected by this. The other thing that the chief said this week is that even with the additional police officers approved in the budget last week by city council, he still thinks more resources are needed. So that's something to watch. How do you deal with that?
Mm-hmm. And we've done a number of programs on this, and we've talked about the rising body count and what may or may not be contributing to it. But one thing CMPD is launching as a result of this are conflict resolution mediation forums, because a lot of people are just getting into an argument, pulling a gun, and blowing the other guy away. So how do they plan to get those who are most likely to do that, to act irrationally and quickly on the spot, to come to these sessions?
To some degree, they've identified individuals who are on the police radar. Some of them are identified through school resource officers. Some of them have previous arrest records. So to some degree, CMPD knows who's more likely to get involved in something like this.
Give them a summons and make them come?
No, do they just invite them?
How do they do it?
It's an invitation. They also rolled out something
else. And are they responding to the invitation? Are they actually coming to these things?
That I'm not sure of.
Okay.
They also rolled out something called the Envision Academy, mm-hmm. where they have identified 30 high school students, and they're going to have paid internships, if you will, this summer. They're not going to work as such, but they're going to go around the city with police officials and others to kind of get an idea of what Charlotte is all about. And I think the idea there is to help them see help these kids see possibilities. There's a saying in the African American community that if you can't see it, you can't be it. And in so many instances, these kids come from neighborhoods, they come from homes where they don't see people getting up, going to work.
Right.
They don't see executives. So the idea is to expose them to parts of Charlotte, everything from culture to environment to sports to government. And at the end of that, in the eighth week, they're going to write about themselves and
right.
how their vision for their own lives.
I mean, that seems so obvious. I mean, how big is that program?
I think it has the potential to be big. It's only 30 kids, but there are a number of other programs out there, as you know. The YMCA has a program mm-hmm. That is trying to get kids off the street at night. So there are a number. It's not just that. There are any number of organizations out there who are working to address this issue and get kids off the street.
Sure. I've seen CMPD really publicizing its PAL, its Police Activities League, in the last even just few weeks, trying to get kids involved in sports. They're really trying to hammer home the point of trying to get to the kids before they get to that point where they're using guns in conflict resolution. I mean, even look at that viral video out of Myrtle Beach this week where you saw the crowd, it looked like getting into a big fight, and then all of a sudden one of the guys takes out a gun and just starts shooting.
Yeah.
So I think that's what they're really trying to get to. What happened in the good old days where we used to just beat each other up? No, I'm just playing, of course. But yeah, I think that's really the point, is to try and get the kids to realize there's different courses you can take. You don't have to reach for the gun. You can find other ways to resolve these conflicts.
But again, if you've never seen any other way to resolve a conflict, that's what you're going to do. So that just seems
absolutely odd. that's
yeah. Well, and to steal a line from Sean from a couple of weeks ago, the other thing that happened with these latest homicides is that, yes, it did become a focal point of the mayor's race yet again. I mean, all of the candidates were tweeting and messaging, fiercely to say that they were the best one to figure this out.
In part because one of the victims this time was a well-known barber with
yes,
no grease.
Right. Well, I was just going to get absolutely. To that because CMPD is increasing foot and bike patrols this summer. But you reported in Q City Metro, Glenn, this week that a drug deal was the probable motive behind a double homicide on Tuesday inside, not outside, but inside an apartment complex, and that popular barber at the No Grease Barbershop was found shot in an SUV
right.
in Northeast Charlotte late Tuesday as well. Would foot patrols have prevented either of those instances?
Probably not. And Chief Putney and Chief Monroe before him said it very publicly. Homicide is one of the hardest crimes to address. It's not a crime of opportunity. Where if you put enough cops on the street, you're going to cut down on muggings, which is a crime of opportunity. You see a victim and you mug them. Homicides are different. They're not typically carried out in public. They're carried out in apartment complexes. They're carried out in cars. They're carried out in dark alleys or wherever.
Right.
And so I think the chief has to do something. I think he's on track to try to get more officers out there and foot patrol. But it's an uphill battle.
Will the death of this barber have an impact? Is it sending a message? Is it reverberating?
It is reverberating. Because we don't know what the motive was in that case.
Mm-hmm.
I would put that out there first and foremost. But it is reverberating because he was well known. A lot of people knew him. Mayoral candidate Vi Lyles, she put out a statement saying he was a good friend of her daughter. She'd been in his presence a number of times and was very impressed with him.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, he and others at the barbershop had been working with CMPD to reduce violence in the community, homicide and other violence. So I think that one is resonating much more than some others. He didn't fit the pattern on the surface. We don't know yet, but on the surface, he doesn't seem to fit the pattern of what we have seen in some of the other homicides.
And the other killing this week that didn't seem to fit the pattern, it was that of a 21-year-old man who went to, I think, an apartment complex in West Charlotte to finish an online purchase. I think it was through Craigslist. I don't know for a fact. But this points up another danger, and that is where and how you complete these legal online sales of merchandise, and the police open their, they can encourage you to come and do it in their lots.
I thought that was really interesting. I'd never even really given it much thought until this popped up, and I saw that statement from the police that they were encouraging people to make those transactions at a police station so that, you know, you're obviously
and police have not definitively said that was the reason, but it was the Let Go app that the brother of the victim believes that he was doing and the reason why he was there. I know other departments around this region, including the Concord Police Department, they actually have a couple parking spots set aside right outside the police station for people to make those transactions, because obviously, if you're right outside a police station, you're probably less likely to commit a crime like that.
Now, Spectrum News, Sean, looked into the homicide rate in Charlotte over the past 10 years. And when you look at it, if I read it correctly, it seems to be like a roller coaster. Would that be correct?
Absolutely. And I think we really need to extend that going over to the 20 years or 25 years when you get back into the early 90s. And, you know, back then, if you talked about 46 homicides in, you know, almost halfway through the year, people would almost be celebrating because the numbers were so much higher than they are now. But the problem is when you take a shorter sample like 10 years and you go back a few years ago when, you know, you've basically already hit the entire year of homicides in just a half a year, that's when it becomes really alarming. That's when you get the political candidates
up in arms. The highest rates of homicide were in 2006 and 2008, and the lowest rate was just 3 years ago in 2014. Do we have any idea why? What fuels this or causes it to decline?
I don't think anyone has really put their finger on it, including the chief, the police, the sociologists.
It's one of those things, too, that's worth noting. I mean, overall, and Sean's report points this out, overall, violent crime statistics both here and nationally are down. And they're down significantly from the heights of the 90s when things were really out of control. But why it's fair, certainly, to worry about what we're seeing specifically with the homicide rate is, if you want to talk about a roller coaster, this is not going up a small kiddie hill. This is dramatically increasing. Granted, it's still lower than historic levels, but going from, 22 at this point last year to, you know, more than 40, that is – it is something that's worth being worried about.
We're going to be doing a public conversation on this. This program will be conducting a public conversation on this on July 11th with several guests, including CMPD Chief Kerr Putney. That will be at the Friendship Missionary Baptist Church, and we'll have more details about that as we get closer to that date. And then – there were five. For months now, Charlotte's Democratic Mayor Jennifer Roberts has been facing a primary challenge of between two other Democrats, of course, Mayor Pro Tem Vi Lyles and State Senator Joel Ford. But now two more Democrats have entered the race, and it all happened literally moments before a scheduled debate. Talk about that, Tom. You were there, I think, and you only have about a minute.
I actually wasn't there. I was down covering the South Carolina primary or the general election. But when I came back to the office, another reporter, Nick Della Canal, was finishing up his story on it, and he just looked at me and said, "This is crazy." And I started asking why, and it's like, well, you know, you're originally supposed to have three Democrats on the stage, Vi Lyles, Jennifer Roberts, and Joel Ford, and then plus Kenny Smith. Kenny Smith turned it down because he's the sole Republican so far running, because he was going to be on a business trip. So there goes one. Joel Ford had to stay in Raleigh because he's a state senator and he's working on the state budget, which was going along. You lose two. But then all of a sudden, two others come forward, and one of them was so last minute that they didn't even have time to print up a name placard for her. So they grabbed a piece of paper and a black Sharpie and scribbled her name down so people would know who she was.
And was she the one that decided at that moment?
As she walked in is what she said.
Lucille Puckett, right?
Yes.
All right, we'll come back and talk about those two new people and what happened at that particular debate. Just that generated two new candidates when we come back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and South State Bank, committed to bridging the gap between a big bank and a small one, offering commercial banking, private banking, and wealth management. Details at southstatebank.com. and Live Nation presenting Chicago and the Doobie Brothers tomorrow at PNC Music Pavilion Charlotte. Tickets at livenation.com. While Washington deals with political turmoil, the economy remains fairly steady. And when President Trump arrived in Washington, there were questions about what impact the reality TV businessman would have on the economy. So far, the needle really hasn't moved, and Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen says the current moderate growth rate is about as good as it gets for now. So we'll take stock of the economy at the halfway point of 2017 with a panel of experts and guest host Tom Bullock on this program Monday at 9.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Coming up on the next On Point, curtains up on the Republican Senate health care bill, the GOP scores in Georgia, dash cam video of the Philando Castile shooting, Otto Warmbier dies. Our weekly news roundtable goes behind the headlines. That's coming up on the next On Point from NPR.
The weekly news roundup continues at 10 with On Point, here on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. It's the local news roundup. And look who's here. Tom Bullock from WFAE News, Glenn Birkins from Q-City Metro, Sean Flynn from Spectrum News Charlotte, and Eric Spanberg from the Charlotte Business Journal. So, two new people entered the mayor's race impromptu at a debate. I think it was this week. So now we have five Democrats competing. What do we know about the two new entries into the race?
Well, we can start with names. There's Lucille Puckett. She was the one who had her, as Eric pointed out, had her name scribbled with black Sharpie because she decided as she walked in that she was indeed going to run for mayor. And I believe she is the mother of, I believe it was her son that was speaking of homicides, that was killed, I believe, last year.
Correct.
And then you have Candace Party Johnson, who
Constance.
I'm sorry,
and that's P-A-R-T-E-E.
Correct. Okay. And she is, I guess you'd say, an entrepreneur. I believe she runs a website that's called it's an African American political website.
City Political.
Thank you, City Political. And then other than that, not a whole lot.
She's run for office a few times.
Has she?
Unsuccessfully. From your own report.
Lucille Puckett has run for office, I think. She ran for both Charlotte Mayor and CMS School Board. Am I right about that?
Yes.
And maybe.
No, you are. And Constance Party Johnson from Nick De La Canal's reporting ran for state senator, chair of the state Democratic Party, and a position on city council in Salisbury.
So what does this do to this race? Because there was a great there was concern, I know, in a lot of corners about Joel Ford and Vi Lyles canceling each other out.
Not much would be the answer. This doesn't do much for the
race. Because people don't know who they are?
Nobody knows who they are. They're getting in at the last minute. They're not going to have money. I mean, the race remains the big three. Unless they're, you know, if they manage to build support, it will be one of the more surprising political stories of the year.
And I have I'm sorry, Glenn, go ahead.
I don't think they're going to draw support. I would differ just a little in that I think you're right. I think it's going to be a race between the big three. But in a tight race or in a race where not many people show up to vote, Even a couple hundred votes can push
that's
it.
True.
One
that's
way
that's
or
absolutely
point.
Right.
Yeah, that's
and,
a fair
and
point.
The one thing I was going to add to that, and Glenn's absolutely right, is it also gives voters options if they're not real big fans of the big three.
Right.
And you know, these two African American women really needed to make a splash if they were. This was their initial foray into the mayor's race.
And did they?
I don't believe so. At time, their answers were a bit disjointed. They certainly didn't have the polish of seasoned candidates, and nor should they. They're not to the same caliber, at least in terms of being a candidate or performing as a candidate, I should say, as Lyles, Ford, and Roberts.
That works for a lot of people. Well, not a lot of people. It works for some big people in our political system right now.
It can work for some, but
you
it's
have to
difficult
have that,
to replicate on a lower, like a city level.
But they don't have recognition in another field.
Yeah,
so that makes it much more difficult.
So did differences emerge? Did they take different points of view on key issues in this debate, or do we know?
Of everything I've seen, there's not a lot of differentiation. And I go back to, particularly with these two candidates, the reason why I think it's so difficult is a lot of people still aren't as aware that Vi Lyles and Joel Ford are in the, you know, relatively speaking. I know they have good name recognition, but I'm just saying it takes so much to get people to pay attention and recognize you're in the race and what you do. I just think it's a hard slog.
Well, on Tuesday, Mayor Roberts' campaign released a poll that they paid for that shows her ahead of Vi Lyles and Joel Roberts by 14 points. She has support of 35% of primary voters. Vi Lyles, 21%. Joel Ford, 15%. But when you take out everybody else and just poll the African-American community, her lead diminishes. She has a 7% lead over those two candidates. Anything unexpected about any of these numbers?
Well, I mean, I think the breaking news is that Jennifer Roberts' campaign likes Jennifer Roberts, so that's, of course, big news.
Is it a legitimate poll?
We don't know because they didn't get the methodology.
Right.
And the reality is, if you go down what few fine points they did put out there, and it could be a legitimate poll, but we don't know because they won't release, you know, the full report, is the survey was 400 people, which is a tiny sample size, and the margin of error was 4.9%, which is high.
And there's no head-to-head. I think that's the big thing that jumps out, is there's not Roberts versus Ford or Roberts versus Lyles. So,
or they didn't release the head-to-head.
Well, that's what I mean. Yeah. We don't know that number is.
It was conducted by Lake Research Partners of Washington, D.C. Do we know anything about that?
Yeah, they've worked with Jennifer Roberts on her congressional campaign and on her last mayoral campaign. So we know that much. But again, like everyone around this table is saying, we just don't know much about how they did it.
Are the other campaigns conducting their own polls?
I don't know.
They might be doing their own internal polls that they're not releasing. Okay. And you're going to start seeing some polls come out here, especially as we get closer to the actual election, which is still a few months away. What I love is how politicians always get these polls and they see the numbers the way they want to see them. So Vi Lyles immediately, you know, or within a day, sent out her own news release saying Jennifer Roberts sends out her own poll that says 2/3 of the people don't like her.
Yeah.
Right. And so it's interesting how they use the numbers however they see fit.
Mayor Roberts has run into this criticism on city policy that led to HB2 and the ensuing struggles over the repeal of that bill along with the riots last summer. But the poll that you referred to said that 64% of likely voters have a favorable opinion of her, with only 25%. Having an unfavorable. So Vi Lyles has inflated the unfavorable.
Well, no, what she was doing is 2/3 of the people surveyed preferred a different candidate. So obviously with Jennifer Roberts only getting 35%, that leaved 65% of the folks. I'm doing math on the radio. That's trouble, folks. Who would like another candidate. That's what she was going for.
And one key point here, too, is a bucket we haven't talked about, which is undecided voters. And that was still significantly high. That was in the high 20s. Mm-hmm. So,
but it's early, right?
Exactly. But which also begs the question of why release this poll now? It's a momentum builder. That's the game here. It's basically, look, we're leading. Try to solidify those people who are supporting you and get others to jump on because everybody loves, you know, the candidate who's winning. So it's not surprising they would release a poll that shows them ahead. I guarantee you if it was a poll that did not show them ahead, they would –
Oh, Tom, now you're breaking my heart.
I'm so cynical.
but it is interesting, you know, because we all know nobody pays attention, relatively speaking, until we get to the fall. But of course, the game here is to get some positive momentum for the diehards and the hardcore
and fundraising
political observers and for the fundraising. And that's why you saw Kenny Smith with the crime ad. What was that last week, I guess? You're seeing Vi Lyles come out with her statements. Joel Ford was pretty forceful about the state budget. That was an interesting debate this week in the mayor's race. Joel Ford saying that, you know, he felt he had to support it because it did all these great things for Charlotte. And Mayor Roberts immediately came out and said that he was, in essence, decimating the fight against crime because of the cuts to the state attorney general's office that are in the state budget. So they're looking for everything and anything to talk about right now.
Well, the father of a teenage girl who contracted a brain-eating amoeba last summer after rafting at the U.S. National Whitewater Center filed suit on Monday on the first anniversary of his daughter's death. That suit was filed in Ohio, where Lauren Seitz lived, and it alleges that park operators showed, quote, conscious disregard for the safety of visitors. Let's go back. The park said it was following state-of-the-art protocols at the time. Regulations by the state and the county weren't updated to govern this one-of-a-kind park. And this amoeba is regularly found in fresh water. So, does this suit have legs?
Well, I'm going to take the counterpoint since you just laid out those points, which are fair and accurate. But one thing that I think has been forgotten a bit is basically a what you could call a whistleblower letter that was sent to county commissioners by a park employee who brought up all kinds of things like the fact that the quality of the water at times in the channel was so bad that rafting guides were often getting, you know, staph infections, ringworm, that they, you know, there were all kinds of issues there. And that is, and I'm not arguing the merits here, I just want to bring up the other side. That is part of what this suit is about. There's also the fact that the Center for Disease Controls and Prevention, when they came up to test that water, found levels of this amoeba, which, yes, absolutely occur naturally in, you know, bodies of water, but they found concentrated levels at the park that were pretty much off the charts.
Yeah, unprecedented levels was the finding there.
And I think it's hard to argue that that you had state-of-the-art technology before when, after her death, that was improved dramatically.
That's a great point.
I can't recall exactly.
They thought it was sufficient state-of-the-art technology.
Sufficient.
Well, there are only, I think, what, three of these facilities in the entire country. This is the only one that wasn't regulated.
I think that is a very important point as you start to go back and forth on
that. That's the state and the county. So are the state and the county being sued, or should they be sued? Should they be part of it?
I think it would be difficult to raise – certainly for the county to sue the county directly, because what mandates the inspection, water quality inspection, in a situation like this is state law. A county is nothing but a subdivision of the state
government. But the health department would have – is this another problem in the
health
department?
There's no law. No, there's no law. There is now, but at the time there was no law. So they were absolutely living up to the Whitewater Center, every expectation.
But it seems like an obvious oversight. Why would you not – choose to regulate a water park when you regulate swimming pools? If you inspect those pools, are the water features at Carowinds regulated or supervised? Are there rules governing them?
Well, there are water parks all over the place, right? And I don't know the specific rules and regulations that deal with water slides, but I want to go back to, I think you've answered your own question, which is this is one of three parks of its kind in the country. So even though the other two may be regulated under different, you know, guidelines, I personally am not surprised to hear that regulation did not keep up with this kind of facility, because it is an oddity. It's a wonderful oddity for people who love it, but it is an oddity, recycled water creating a man-made rafting channel in a closed circuit. It's just not something that you tend to find everywhere.
Well, what's the difference between that and a swimming pool?
Municipal water supplies versus taking water from the Catawba. You're not going to be pulling Carowinds Water Park water directly from, you know, a river that's going by. But that's where the water was coming from with the Whitewater Center.
Okay. So has there been any comment about this from the Whitewater Center?
I have not seen.
We've heard very few comments from the Whitewater Center over the last year regarding this issue.
Right.
Even when they were asked multiple times, even by county commissioners to talk, they were very tight-lipped about the whole thing. So it does not surprise me one little bit when you mentioned lawsuit that they're not commenting about it, because they haven't really commented all that much
is the plaintiff asking for?
I believe the number was about $500,000for the case, and then another $1 million+ for just punitive damages. Mm-hmm.
This is the kind of lawsuit that I would be very surprised if it ever actually reaches court.
Right. Totally agree.
They will probably settle.
Well, and some of this is tied into the health department. I guess they would have been in charge of inspecting this, but there were no regulations, so they didn't need to inspect it. But yesterday it was announced that former Wake and Buncombe County Health Director Alma Gibby Harris had been named interim Mecklenburg County Health Director starting next week, and the current Health Director, Marcus Plesha, whose resignation takes effect on August the 4th, will be helping guide her through the transition period. But this morning it was reported that there are some people on, I think, County Commission who have said that this raises the specter of conflict of interest. Talk about that.
Well, I mean, it all boils down to the fact that she is the new interim health director, is also part of the consulting team that the county is paying to do a full report to see what happened with the county health department. So you can look at this in a couple of different ways. Ms. Harris also happens to be a former award winner of, you know, Health Commissioner of the Year for North Carolina. She is well respected for what she does. But she's still being paid, or at least the company that she is a partner of is being paid by the county to run a diagnostic test, in essence, of the county health department. And there are concerns that have been raised specifically, I believe it was Jim Puckett.
Yeah,
Jim Puckett
sent again. A blistering letter.
Yeah. That's like, okay, well, because she is now the interim director, is she going to skew the results of that report? Are we going to get an honest feedback? Because, you know, it's one thing to hire away a consultant. My wife is a consultant, like, or was a consultant. A client hired her away. That happens all the time. But it's the timing is the optical problem here, yeah, because the report is still being done.
So she's her company, which she's a founding partner of, is doing the analysis of what's going on. But as interim health director, she's being paid $20,000 a month for that job. Is she being paid directly, or is her company being compensated? Because she's a partner in the company. Is she leaving the company to do this?
I don't believe she has said. I'm not sure I can answer that question.
Yeah. And I think the county manager's argument is that there are actually two studies going on. One is looking at the clinics and the client-facing side of the business. Mm-hmm. She's not doing that part. And I think that's the argument that the county manager makes. Her firm is more looking at the management, how kind of the top-level management of the health department. So I think that they feel that there's less potential for conflict of interest because she's not involved in what could potentially be the most contentious part of these dual reports.
And what's going on here is Puckett and Pat Cotham both, but particularly Jim Puckett, who sent out this blistering email this week, said that the optics look horrible. That he responded to the county manager's response by saying, "I'm not necessarily saying that there is a conflict of interest or that you're doing something wrong, but even the merest hint is damaging because the public is so unsettled by what's happened in the health department." And Dina DiIorio did not back down. She said, "Look, this is the best course for us. I would rather people focus on the facts and not the optics." And so that's where we are at the moment.
So she's the interim. Why only interim? Why not just hire her? Or why not promote somebody from within with the supervision of this company that's doing the analysis?
Well, I don't have a definitive answer, but my first guess would be because Gibby Harris is running her own company, she probably agreed to do it for 6 months or 9 months, right, however long it takes, because she wants to just keep running her company long term.
Well, and I also think, let's face it, I think the county wants Plesha to be effectively out of managing the health department as quickly as possible. The interim step allows you to do that,
right,
with him on as, you know, the tutor, as you were, or the guide, the left seat, right seat kind of thing, while you still have a national search or potentially an internal search to find a long-term candidate replacement.
Okay. Mecklenburg County Commission also on Tuesday voted to put a nearly $1 billion bond package for schools on the November ballot. The last CMS bond referendum in 2013 was for $290 million. This is two-thirds more.
Largest one ever.
Have there been bonds on that? So there's never been a bond.
Not in Mecklenburg County.
Not in Mecklenburg County. There's not been a bond.
In Wake County, I believe there was one larger one. That's it.
So what will this money be used for if the bond passes?
Well, they would build 10 new schools. They would replace, I think,
seven
schools. And there are 12 more schools that would get extensive renovations of classrooms and other facilities. So I think it's pretty clear to most people that there's a lot of need out there. Now, there is immediately the question about how this particular package was assembled, and that starts with West Charlotte and Bruns, because Commissioner Vilma Leek, whose district, the county district, includes those schools, lobbied very aggressively to get them included in the package, and they were added late in the game.
And Jim Puckett, who's the one commissioner who voted against the package in District 1, there are no schools slated to be built in that district.
Yes, and in fact, I spoke with the new superintendent, Clayton Wilcox, and he, among others, said you have to look at this in its totality, that the northern part of Mecklenburg County has gotten a lot in previous rounds, so this makes sense from that standpoint.
So we'll talk more about that when we come back, the possibility of MLS in Charlotte, and also the budget, the state budget, when we come back. The Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Corkscrew Wine Shop and Bar. New location now open at The View in downtown Charlotte near BB&T Ballpark. Full portfolio of wine and beer from all over the world, plus live music. Details at thescrewcrew.com. And Urgent Vet Pet Clinic, providing veterinary urgent care 365 days a year for Charlotte pet owners. Locations now open in Fort Mill and Belmont. Your pet can't wait to feel better. More info at urgentvet.com. Senate Republicans take the wrapper off their health care bill. Special congressional elections in South Carolina and Georgia yield narrow GOP wins. And a week after a not guilty verdict in a Minnesota police shooting, dash cam footage of the deadly encounter is released. Those stories and more on the national and international version of the News Roundup with Tom Ashbrook on point in 20 minutes.
Between meetings, appointments, reminders, staying in tune with the news can seem tough.
It was a truck bomb.
Supreme Court to lift an injunction that bars the government.
NPR News checks the facts and adds background so you know what's going on. You understand why and maybe what it means. Stand with the facts. Listen every day.
News you can trust from 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, the local news roundup featuring Sean Flynn, managing editor of Spectrum News Charlotte, Glenn Birkins, editor-publisher of QCityMetro.com, Eric Spanberg, senior staff writer for the Charlotte Business Journal, and Tom Bullock, reporter for WFAE News. We were talking before the break about Mecklenburg County putting the bond, a $1 billion bond proposal on the November ballot. There was a school bond, several years ago. People don't always understand how these work. Has the money from that bond been spent yet?
All of the money been spent? Yeah. No.
And that's normal?
That's normal.
It is normal.
Yes. And that's not just schools. That's pretty much every walk of government life.
Because
yes.
they put these bonds forth to fund specific projects on a timeline.
Correct.
Okay. So, meanwhile, the county has also put forth a $1.6 billion budget plan that Commissioner Trevor Furlong has called an example of conservative fiscal management. What does it include?
Well, that's your typical operating budget
right.
for the county. So, you know, your health services, all the things, park and rec, all the things that the county overseas, schools, obviously. So,
$65 million of it goes to, and this is all part of this North Tryon Street revitalization. $65 million goes to rebuilding or
That's the part library. Of the that's part of the capital improvement plan. I don't believe that's part of the
You're
operating
right.
budget.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Then there's two budgets going on.
Yes, and it's always that way with both city
okay.
and county.
Well, then let's talk about that, because a lot of people would look at the main library, which is steps away from where we're sitting right now, and go, "That's brand new."
Oh, no.
And they're going to tear it down?
Isn't it almost 30 years old, I think, that building is?
Yeah, as I said, it's brand new.
Yes, it's brand new. It's 30 years old, brand new.
There are buildings in Rome that are thousands of years old.
Well, look who joined us. Very nice.
The Capitol building in Washington is more than 20 minutes old.
The professor has joined us. Well, Thucydides.
The Charlotte Coliseum didn't make it to 30, so why should the library?
So, yes, you're right, Mike. This is a little bit younger than the famous buildings in Rome. However, this has been a...
And Rome wasn't built in a day.
Oh, that's, as I understand it, was not.
it had a lengthy... Already.
There was a lengthy decline and fall. But with the library in particular, these talks actually started right before the recession. There was this idea of redeveloping the whole block and bringing in the usual apartments and offices and all those things. And then I think there was a little problem with our national economy, and that right. kind of fell away. And so now that is largely being revived. The other aspect pertaining specifically to the library is that not just in Charlotte but everywhere there is a feeling that the use of libraries is changing, obviously
sure.
because of digital technology and all those things. And so they want to build a next version of the library.
Okay.
And that's all I can tell you, other than the Dewey Decimal System is a great thing.
Okay. But they delayed a vote on the soccer stadium
Uh-oh.
Until August. Why?
Well, because they want the city to
They
hope and want and need the city to chip in $44 million. And you remember in January this came up. It was going to be a dual vote.
Yeah.
And the only problem was the city decided they wouldn't vote. So
we had a little negotiating session on Saturday night in view of about 400 people between Dina DiIorio, the county manager, and and Jennifer Roberts, the mayor. Glenn was a witness to this.
How'd it go?
They were very noncommittal. needless to say, a deal was not struck.
Essentially, buyer's remorse for the county right now, and they're trying to see if they can get their money back.
Okay. Charlotte School of Law, their travails continue. They hired Paul Meggett to be their new interim dean. He's already a member of the staff there, an associate professor. Two previous deans stepped down. The last one, Scott Broyles, said he was exasperated by the position. He said, if I can't do anything, why keep the job?
This is the third interim dean in as many months.
And now they have until early August, which is about 6 weeks, to prove their financial stability or face revocation of their license to operate in North Carolina. What hoops will they have to jump through between now and August?
Well, if we're going to keep the Rome, analogy going
here. And please
here,
do.
They will not be like the Roman Empire and have a long, disastrous
They're being
fall.
Thrown to the lions, you might say.
There we go. There it is. The hoops are significant, and it's not just with their funding. They need to try to get back in the good graces of the American Bar Association accreditation program by coming up with a new plan either to do what's called teach out, which is allow the students who are still enrolled, and there aren't many of them.
About 100, I
think. About 100, yep. To be taught at another law school if the Charlotte School of Law goes belly up. They need to find a way to secure funding they should have already had in place, which are these bonds, where basically, you know, when you start a semester, you pay your entire tuition up front.
Right.
That money is supposed to basically be used to secure a bond in case something bad happens to the school and they can't provide you that education. Charlotte School of Law has no guarantee bond.
Why not?
You'd have to ask them that, because they're supposed to. And in addition to that, they need to make sure that their federal funding magically reappears in the next 6 weeks. And that was pulled because of the long aforementioned problems they've had with admitting underqualified students, an incredibly poor passage rate for the bar examination on first try, and a myriad of other issues.
The only slight hope that I guess they would have on that last issue is that the current administration is much more open to this type of school.
For-profit colleges.
Why? Than the last administration. We'd have to ask Betsy DeVos that question, and there could be grizzly bears in the classroom, so I'm going to
refrain. So you're telling me there's a glimmer of hope that
well,
the school
in part, well, I'm just saying on that one issue, but I mean, you just outlined pretty extensively. Yeah, and the other thing is, and Tom mentioned 100 students, or you mentioned 100 students. 3 years ago, they were at 1,400, so that shows you that there are huge problems there.
And in addition, you know, one of the things our reporter Gwendolyn Glenn pointed out, which I thought was interesting, I didn't realize, is they also have they owe stockholders. You know, there's a payout that they're thinking about, you know, having to – they're not, I don't know if they're thinking about it or not, even if they're capable or not. But they're talking about having to pay, you know, their corporate debt and shareholders, because this is a for-profit corporation.
But there are two other schools. There's one in Florida, one in Arizona, owned by this Infolaw company.
Yep.
Which
I'm not sure. I know that at least one of those schools is under a similar hard look from the American Bar Association accreditation program. I'm not sure whether it's the one in Florida or the one in Arizona. But needless to say, I bring this up because the financial support that this school, the Charlotte School of Law, would need in the next really quick turnaround – 6 weeks is not long for something like this – is not necessarily going to be coming from the mothership.
So let's play a little game here. Who has a better chance, MLS stadium funding or Charlotte School of Law?
I do not
Please make your entries now.
Oh, man.
Well, let's change the subject. The North Carolina House approved a final compromise budget over objections of Democrats, saying it included millions in pork projects for mostly Republican districts. And I think you reported on this morning, Tom, that in many of those districts, these pork pork projects were to revitalize essentially downtowns that really don't exist in some of these areas.
Yeah, I wouldn't say in many. These are just some examples. And this one I just plucked because I found it really fascinating. $5.6 million off the top of my head? Somewhere, you know, between $5.5 and $6 million for downtown revitalization projects, specifically geared towards certain communities only. So it's not like a grant that everybody can put in for. But two of the places that this is earmarked for are unincorporated. So they're not even towns, which means they don't actually have a downtown to revitalize, but they still get to revitalize their non-existent downtowns with state money.
And this budget is now complete. The Senate's voted and they've come
houses
to,
too.
And they've come to agreement and they're going to send it to the governor if they haven't already. It gives what? Teacher pay raises of about 3.3% weighted toward experience.
For the first year, it goes up significantly for the second year.
And it raises state employees' salaries as well. There's also tax cuts for whom and by how much?
Those will come in 2019, and this is similar, although not exactly like the much heralded billion-dollar middle tax, middle class tax cut that the Senate passed earlier.
Just subtract $400 million and you're there.
Yeah, but basically, the corporate interest rate will go down by from 3% to 2.5%. The personal income tax rate drops from what is it, 5.499%
to 5.25%.
Yeah, so and it does increase. It's not just, you know, overall brackets. It does increase the standard deduction, which is an amount that families can take or individuals can take if they don't itemize. It increases that amount from $17,500 to $20,000 for couples that filed jointly.
Is this significant? Will people feel this?
Some will, absolutely. I mean, that basically means that, you know, now the first $20,000 of your income, if you do not itemize, is tax-free. But there's something a little bit Sean's doing math. I can see.
I'm doing the math. I mean, you're talking a couple hundred dollars for some of those folks.
Yeah, which could make a difference. I mean, they'll
absolutely
feel it.
I mean, it's a tax
cut. The governor doesn't like this bill at all. He's expected to veto the bill, and here's why.
This budget prioritizes tax breaks for the wealthy and corporations, and shortchanges education and economic development. And I think it may be the most fiscally irresponsible budget I've ever seen.
Why?
Well, the economic debate that we've been having and continue to have is this idea of cutting taxes and putting money in the rainy day fund, essentially, on the Republican side. And what the Democrats are saying, particularly Roy Cooper, is saying is we as a state have cut enough in terms of taxes and that we need to be investing in schools, education, healthcare to really lift people up and strengthen the overall economy. So it is a basic philosophical difference, and you're seeing it play out again and again.
There's one other thing, too, and that's some of these cuts that appeared out of nowhere. I mean, normally when you have a House budget and a Senate budget, they get together, they compromise, they come out with a compromise budget that includes provisions that were at least found in one of those two original documents. There are a lot of things here that just came out of nowhere.
Right.
One of them, how about a 17% cut to the governor's administrative budget? That is just another hit at the governor from the Republican-controlled legislature. But the more troubling one, potentially, is the cuts to the attorney general's office, another elected Democrat. And, you know, the Republicans say it's around a 10% cut. Other departments have had to deal with that. But it's not. The overall number is correct. But this is $10 million taken out of the $23 million bucket to pay salaries for administrative staff and lawyers. So
about 123 people, he said.
Stein said we'll have to lay off, including that you said the vast majority, frankly, are going to be lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a major hit. I mean, enough that, you know, the State Association of Chiefs of Police and the district attorneys, they've all come back to the legislature and said, do not do this. This will hurt our ability to prosecute criminals. We need these lawyers.
And that's deliberately punitive?
I think it's fair to see it that way. I mean, I'll let Senate Pro Tem Phil Berger, his words kind of explain his point of view on this just directly. When asked about why, he said it's because the attorney general does not see that his primary job is to serve his client, and his client is the state of North Carolina, specifically its representatives in the General Assembly.
And, that's tied to his lack of will to defend the state against this
voting law,
which
the Supreme Court
has
struck
down.
Yeah. And this is
– Small world, isn't it?
I do think it's worth noting this came after that decision was made.
Okay.
So,
meanwhile, Mecklenburg Republican Senator Jeff Tart said that if Governor Cooper vetoes the budget – it will put at risk several things, including the fact that 16 and 17-year-olds will no longer be tried as adults for crimes. And people might hear that and say, well, what has that got to do with the budget? The Senate puts policy into the budget, right?
Well, but this is a combination. And yes, the Senate is notorious for it. Now the House negotiators have done it as well. And here's where we get back to pork. In that provision, it's called Raise the Age. North Carolina is the last state in the union to try 16 and 17-year-olds as adults. Tied to that provision is a measure which mandates the state has to spend $13.5 million to build a new juvenile detention facility, and it has to be built in Rockingham County, which just happens
who is from Rockingham
to
County?
Be where Senate Pro Tem Phil Berger is from.
That's right. That's right.
It's you wanted to. We were talking about optics before. It's hard. You can make easily say that optics are the very minimal problem here, but the optics are really bad.
Well, and it's interesting. Berger and Tim Moore, the House Speaker, you know, they have all these dueling statements when the budget comes out, and they immediately said to the governor, he will have lost credibility with the voters if he vetoes, and we will quickly override your veto. Governor, keep your promises to the voters. And so what the Republicans are arguing is not only do it our way, but that this budget addresses the things that you've said are the key issues for the state.
Yeah. So will he veto it?
He hasn't said officially yet, but given the you know, the bit of him talking that you just played and given all the everything else and the controversy inside this budget, I think the safe bet is that a big red stamp, it will be pulled out and something will be mashed on the cover of that budget.
So we did a whole hour on this earlier in the week, so I don't spend a lot of time on it. But South Carolina voters in that state's 5th Congressional District decided to send former Republican state legislator Ralph Norman to Congress to fill Tea Party Republican Mick Mulvaney's seat. He's now the budget director for the Trump White House. He faced a political novice in that race, a Democrat, Archie Parnell. Parnell lost, but it was way closer than it probably should have been. It certainly was expected to be. What message has that sent?
It sends a message to the National Democratic Party. You chose the wrong race to dump all that money in because they lost Georgia and it didn't do it. They dumped all that money in Georgia and they lost
that. That, too, was close, however.
No, I talked to Scott Huffman, who's a frequent contributor to all of our shows, who said that anything under 10% is a win for Democrats.
Well, last night was NBA draft night.
Woohoo!
Yes.
I mean that sincerely.
Prior to the NBA draft, however, the Hornets were already able to snag Dwight Howard from Atlanta. And the Observer, Scott Fowler, said basically they got Howard for a couple of packs of Twizzlers that cost about $23.5 million a year.
And just like movie prices.
And last night in the draft, they used their number 11 overall pick to select Kentucky shooting guard Malik Monk.
Malik Monk.
You're on. Malik Monk.
Malik
Talk.
Monk. Well,
speak.
Hey.
Enlighten us.
I think that was the logical pick, but I'm going to defer to Sean because he was raring to go when we came in.
Well, do it.
Oh, I'm just super excited. I think in the last 2 days, my friends who really don't care all that much about the Hornets were actually texting last night and the night before with the Howard thing. They're really excited about it. The second round pick that they had has the best name in the draft, Dwayne Bacon.
All right.
But he loves bacon.
Everybody likes bacon. Sean Flynn, managing editor from Spectrum News, Charlotte, Eric Spanberg from the Business Journal, Glenn Berkins, QCityMetro.com, and Tom Bullock from WFAE News. Thank you all for the hour. We love you. We love you. We love you.